the fundamental attributes of knowledge, love, and will. All the spiritual attributes, of course, not the physical ones. So, these are the fundamental capacities of the human being. And as we said, because the soul is immortal, because the capacities of the soul are eternally fixed, they can neither be destroyed nor changed. The soul is not threatened either by death nor mutilation. The soul is absolutely above any threat of either death, that is destruction, non-existence, or mutilation. But the soul is threatened, if you will, by another thing, and that is undevelopment. Because these capacities are latent within the human reality, as Baha'u'llah said. Because, as Hussein explained so beautifully in his talk the other day, because these capacities are in a state of potential at creation. And Baha'u'llah says that this potential can only be made manifest as a result of our efforts. Then there is the possibility that we do not respond appropriately, that we do not make sufficient effort, and therefore these remain undeveloped. So the essential threat to the soul is undevelopment, or what amounts to the same thing, false development or improper development. Now, this dialogue with God, then, the parameters of which are established in the Kitab-i Aqdas, the parameters of the mature dialogue between God and man, is the context in which this development takes place. And what are the signs of development? Well, we've already said in making the analogy of the material world, this is an increase in autonomy and an increase in well-being. And as I said yesterday, every principle has both a positive articulation and a negative articulation. So we can say, what are the signs of undevelopment? We can turn it around and say, what does it mean not to be developed? And that is the opposite of autonomy and well-being. What is the opposite of autonomy? It is dependencies, unnaturally restrictive dependencies, of which drug abuse and alcohol abuse are only the grossest and most obvious examples. But we know that one can be dependent, unnaturally dependent on anything, on the support of other people or whatever, whatever. In fact, this is the, sort of the main theme of modern psychology. Would you agree with this, Hussein, that the main preoccupation of modern psychology is how do we get rid of all of these unnatural dependencies? How do we own our life? How do we acquire autonomy? People have suddenly realized that they're not autonomous, and they don't know how do we get in this condition of these unnatural dependencies, and how do we get out of it? Would you agree with that? Or? Well, the California brand seems to be pretty much in the... Okay. Okay. So this is it. You see, the main preoccupation of materialistic psychology is to somehow defeat these unnatural dependencies, and this is what gives rise to you do your own thing, and so on and so on, okay? And this is the whole basis of political correctness. In other words, if you feel unhappy with the fact that you are obviously limited because you have some kind of restriction in your personality, in your functioning, you can't function without a homosexual relationship or without being sexually promiscuous, or without having drugs and alcohol, Well, what you do then is change the rules so that nobody devalues you because of that. In other words, you go out and change society so that it's acceptable to be an alcoholic or a drug addict or a homosexual or sexually promiscuous. Okay? And so it then becomes politically incorrect. It becomes unacceptable socially to even point out that this is unnatural. You know, recently, a real estate salesman was successfully sued in the United States because he put an ad in the newspaper advertising that he had a house for sale that had a beautiful view. And the Association for the Blind said that this was discrimination against the blind because the blind couldn't see the view. And he was successfully sued for doing that. Okay? So in other words, this is not going to make blind people see anymore. But in other words, it is unacceptable to remind blind people that they're blind or to acknowledge in public discourse that blind people are blind. And another thing which is even more appalling but less surprising, recently, this was just a few days, I don't know if you've heard about this one, this is really great, because you can probably tell horror stories that are worse than this one, but in Vancouver, do you know about this? A gynecologist was successfully sued. He was judged guilty by a human rights panel and forced to pay a fine to a lesbian couple because he refused artificial insemination to the couple. In other words, it was judged that he did not, as a practicing physician, he did not have the right to refuse artificial insemination to a lesbian couple. This was discrimination against this couple. That's pretty far from the concept of the family that's in the Kitabiaka, right? So, one form of undevelopment is these unnatural dependencies. The other is the opposite of well-being, a lack of well-being, which is simply a fancy way of saying that you're unhappy. Okay? In other words, the result of unspirituality is this, simply that you're unhappy. In the same way that physical pain is the sign that something is wrong with your physical body, unhappiness is psychological pain or spiritual pain is the sign that something is wrong spiritually. Okay? So the product of spiritual development is increasing autonomy and increasing happiness and well-being. It's just that simple. Now, how do we achieve autonomy? We achieve autonomy by recognizing our total dependency on God. In other words, I said that lack of autonomy was an unnatural dependency. I didn't say that it was just dependency, because there are dependencies that are natural and healthy. We depend on food, physically. But that's a natural dependency, and that's a healthy dependency. We should eat nutritious food. Dependency on alcohol is an unnatural dependency. It is a created dependency. Now, ultimately, everything comes from God, so we are totally dependent on God. So to have faith in God doesn't mean to become dependent on God. This, again, is the materialistic view of faith. And this is why materialists often say that believers in God are weak people. They say, you need the crutch of belief in God, right? This is what they say. They say, well, belief in God is a crutch. It's a defense mechanism against reality. Or it's an opiate, as Lenin said. Well, of course, some forms of religion are crutches, and some forms of religion are defense mechanisms, and some form of religion are opiates. But true religion, true belief in God, means becoming aware of a reality that is already there, and that reality is our total dependency on God. Let me explain a little bit more what I mean by this. Now, in talking about visible and invisible reality, I took this example of gravity, right? I took this example of gravity. Now, maybe your reaction to this is, well, that's too simple. You know, I mean, that's so everyday. Surely that isn't a convincing argument for invisible reality, because what could be more commonplace than gravity? Surely scientists would have realized by now that the gravity, the effect of which everybody observes, is an immediate proof of invisible reality. Why don't they observe this? I'll tell you why. Because they take it for granted. In other words, gravity is so commonplace, we depend on it so unconsciously, we assume it so thoroughly, that we are unaware of its implications. We are unaware that it is an immediate experience of invisible reality. Okay? It is the same thing with God. God is hidden from us not by his remoteness, but by his very nearness. What hides God from us is that we depend on him so thoroughly that we take it for granted. And this is why in the Kitabiyat class, Baha'u'llah has this language, such as the passage that we studied yesterday, where he says, you know, where's the glory of those who have gone before you? What that ye possess can be, can you claim to be lasting and permanent and so on? This reflection about the fact that whatever degree of stability or permanence we have in our life is due not to the inherent properties of these things, but to God. It is God who allows us to own these things temporarily. If we have prosperity, that comes from God. If we don't have prosperity, that comes from God. In other words, we depend so thoroughly on God. We depend so completely on God that we are unaware of it. God is hidden from us not by farness, but by nearness. There's an example that Abdu'l-Bahá gave, which I like very much in this regard. Someone once asked Abdu'l-Bahá how it is that one could become immersed in God. Abdu'l-Bahá said, how can a straw basket contain water? So the person said, oh, you mean a straw basket? He said, yeah, a straw basket. He said, well, if you put water in a straw basket, it just goes right through. So a straw basket can't contain water. And Abdu'l-Bahá said, suppose you immerse the straw basket in the ocean. Then it is full of water. So we can't contain God, but we can be contained in God. In fact, we are immersed in this ocean. But because we are constantly immersed in the ocean, we don't know what it would be like not to be immersed in the ocean. And therefore, we succumb to the illusion that we are not immersed in this ocean. So acquiring faith means acquiring knowledge of our dependency on God. This is the Bill Hatcher definition of faith, if you will. Abdu'l-Bahá's definition is faith is conscious knowledge and then good deeds. So I like to say, I mean, probably Abdu'l-Bahá said this somewhere, but I, you know. So I expand this notion of knowledge as simply saying faith is conscious awareness of our dependency on God. The dependency is an objective fact. Nothing changes in reality when we become believers. The only thing that changes is our consciousness of reality, our awareness of the dependency that is already there. Therefore, the first specific law of the Kitab-i Aqdas is the law of prayer. The fundamental relationship of all existence is the relationship between the individual and God. That is, the awareness that we are immersed in the ocean of God at all times. Well, let's see what Shoghi Effendi says about this. Okay? It's on page 213, under the section, The Individual Dialogue with God. Well, let's just read the preamble because it sums up the thing. Having established in the opening passages the fundamental premise of the Kitab-i Aqdas, the collective and individual dialogue or covenant between God and humanity, Baha'u'llah now turns in paragraphs 6 to 15 to the first specific and most basic law of the Kitab-i Aqdas, the law of prayer. Prayer is the foundation of the individual dialogue between God and man. Through it, the individual establishes a direct, unmediated inner connection between his soul and God. Moreover, this relationship is the most fundamental of all relationships accessible to the individual. Unless this relationship be correctly and firmly established, all other relationships, whether with other individuals, with society, or with nature, will be essentially flawed. The following statement, written on behalf of Shoghi Effendi, illustrates the importance Baha'u'llah gives to prayer. Well, I tried to get out all the unnecessary that's. I see I didn't get that one out. Okay. How to attain spirituality is indeed a question to which every young man and woman must sooner or later try to find a satisfactory answer. Indeed, the chief reason for the evils now rampant in society is the lack of spirituality. The materialistic civilization of our age has so much absorbed the energy and interest of mankind that people in general do no longer feel the necessity of raising themselves above the forces and conditions of their daily material existence. There is not sufficient demand for things we call spiritual to differentiate them from the needs and requirements of our physical existence. The universal crisis affecting mankind is therefore essentially spiritual in its causes. Well, that's just what we've been talking about. The cause of every observable condition is a spiritual thing, okay? Whether positive or negative, the cause of negative material conditions is also a spiritual cause. Now get this next phrase. The core of religious faith is that mystic feeling which unites man with God. This state of spiritual communion can be brought about and maintained by means of meditation and prayer, and this is the reason why Baha'u'llah has so much stressed the importance of worship. Get the next phrase. The Baha'i faith, like all other divine religions, is thus fundamentally mystic in character. Its chief goal is the development of the individual and society through the acquisition of spiritual virtues and powers. These powers give us increased autonomy. The virtues give us increased happiness. It is the soul of man which has to be fed, and this spiritual nourishment prayer can best provide. So Baha'u'llah ordains obligatory prayer. But he makes it clear that obligatory prayer is a minimum, not a maximum. It is the minimal obligation. Because, as Shoghi Effendi here says, we must move to a point where we live in a constant state of spiritual communion with God. So look on page 215, just above the middle of the page, there's a short in-text quotation from Shoghi Effendi where he describes this state of continual spiritual communion with God. He says, quote, "We must become entirely selfless and devoted to God so that every day and every moment we seek to do only what God would have us do and in the way he would have us do it." So we must become so thoroughly aware of our dependence on God that at every second of our existence, we are consciously aware of the presence of God. And that everything we do from that awareness. Now, the way one does this, there's a certain creative latitude involved in this, and this is something which could be the object of a complete course, is what you might call techniques for doing this, but I don't like the word technique. I would say rather the spiritual process that leads us to this. But we can maybe talk about this in the discussion this afternoon or whatever. But it is a dialectical process or a dialogue which involves all of the three capacities of knowledge, of love, and of will. In other words, it is not just a question of saying, oh, now I understand, I am totally dependent on God. The fact that you understand intellectually that you are totally dependent on God does not make you aware of the ways in which you are dependent. Therefore, you must act. You must go pioneering. You must teach the faith. Abdu'l-Bahá says that if we don't teach the faith, then we cannot experience the confirmations of God. Shoghi Effendi goes even further. He makes the frightening statement, the sustaining power of Baha'u'llah himself will be totally withdrawn from any Baha'i who does not in the long run arise. Let me repeat that. The sustaining power of Baha'u'llah will be totally withdrawn from any Baha'i who does not in the long run arise. Okay? These are realities. Now you say, well, that's frightening. Well, fear is an appropriate response. Fear is an awareness of a threat. What is the threat? It is the threat of undevelopment. So physical death and physical mutilation are metaphors for spiritual death, which is not non-existence, but undevelopment. So we are threatened by spiritual death, which is this sleep that Hussein was talking about. This sleep of unawareness, which in its most extreme form is equivalent to death, the sleep of death. So this process is a dialectical process that involves intellectual understanding, implementation through action of that understanding, and it involves then a pursuit of the love of God, which is experienced as an attraction for that which is valuable. Put another way, we can say that all of morality is summed up in one single slogan. Never sacrifice the higher to the Lord. The higher should never be used as a means to attain the lower. Now this presumes, of course, that you already know what is higher and what is lower. So it begins with knowledge, that's obvious. But once we have a knowledge of spiritual reality, once we understand this hierarchy of higher and lower that we were talking about last night, okay. Once we have this knowledge of the law of causality, of this hierarchy of cause and effect, then we implement this knowledge on the basis of the following norm, which is the one universal moral norm, namely, you always use the lower as a means to attain the higher. And this is at every level of existence. In other words, I use the lower levels of material reality to attain the higher levels of material reality, to obtain the lower levels of spiritual reality to obtain the higher levels of spiritual reality. And so remember last night, Abdu'l-Bahá said that everything is universal with respect to what is below it, in particular with respect to what is above it. He said specifically, this is incidental and relative. And in some answered questions, he says what? The good deeds of the faithful are the sins of the near one. So what is a good action for an ordinary believer, that same action with the same motivation would be a sin for a person who is more advanced. And there's no limit. This is an eternal process of growth and development. So what is the fundamental principle by which we advance? It is at every moment, as Shoghi Effendi says, in every day, at every moment, we are intensely aware of the presence of God in our life, and we therefore relate to reality on the basis of its structure. And the essence of that relationship is that we always use the lower as a means to obtain the higher. And this is the latter by which we grow or develop or mount. As Abdu'l-Bahá himself has said, that prayer is the ladder by which the soul ascends. Now, isn't this amazing? Isn't this amazing? Here, for 6,000 years, humanity has awaited the revelation of the most holy book. And we were all trembling in our boots, you know, what is this book of laws going to be? And what is it? It is a love letter from God to us. It says, I love you. You're valuable. I want to commune with you at every moment of your existence. That's the Kitab-i-Aqdas. It is the law of love. It is the enshrinement of the eternal law of love. So I think I'll stop there, and we have a few minutes for questions that you may have that are specific to the relationship. Yes. Yeah. Okay, I'll say a few things, but I'm afraid of a too cursory treatment. But at the basis of it, and of course I'm speaking partly from my own personal experience and what I've observed, so this is necessarily tinged with all the human limitations that are involved. But most fundamentally, it involves a ruthless will to the truth. And most fundamentally, a ruthless will to the truth about oneself. One has to want to know the truth. At some point, one has to make a fundamental decision that it is better to know the truth, however unpleasant it may be initially, because ultimately it is knowledge of the truth that will produce my autonomy and my well-being. In other words, once having become a believer, once having satisfied ourselves that God exists, that God loves us, that God does everything for our benefit, we should then lose our fear of the truth. In other words, the truth cannot ever really hurt us. So what hurts us when we say the truth hurts when we find out that somebody we thought loved us didn't love us, when somebody betrays us, when we find out that some ability we thought we had we didn't really have, or whatever. Okay? When we discover a truth which is initially unpleasant, we have to have such faith in truth itself, which is nothing more than God. I mean, God is truth. We have to have such faith in the power of truth that we know that truth and knowledge of the truth will increase our autonomy and our well-being. And this will give us the courage to face the initially unpleasant truths. I mean, not all truths will be unpleasant. I mean, some of the truths will be marvelous and exalting and euphoric. You know, just like last night. I mean, we had a lot of fun with this, right? I mean, you know, it opened up the horizon and so on. So, I mean, not all truths are unpleasant. So I don't want to give the idea that, you know, this is necessarily experienced as a primarily negative process. But let me put it this way, and maybe this is more relevant to North Americans than it is to Europeans and especially Eastern Europeans. But you know, we Baha'is, we say that society is sick, right? We say society is sick. We say that the world is suffering from materialism, from ungodliness. It has strayed from God. It has disobeyed God. It does not have knowledge of spiritual reality. It is full of hatred. Instead of love, we have hatred. And we have false loves. In other words, attractions to lower things instead of higher things, such as homosexuality and sexual promiscuousness and all these things, and drugs and alcohol, which creates temporary happiness or euphoria, but is followed by greater unhappiness and increased dependency and so on. So we see all of these things. And when we teach the faith, that's what we tell people, right? We say, you know, look, you know, you want a solution to the problems? Here it is, by faith. But then, once we're in the faith, when it comes to changing our lifestyle, we're reluctant to do that. You know? I mean, one of the big issues in the North American Baha'i community, and I just gave this same course at Lew Helen, which is a Baha'i school in the United States. And I was, I don't know if I was surprised, but I was certainly dismayed to find out that still, at this stage of the development of the faith in North America, one of the major issues, I mean, this is a hot issue in the American Baha'i community, is what to tell your kids about Santa Claus. Santa Claus. This is a burning issue. I am not kidding. I am not exaggerating. I spent a whole hour discussing this with the class. What? Well, I'll tell you what my wife told my daughter when she was 5 years old and saw a Santa Claus on the street, you know, Salvation Army Santa Claus ringing a bell, you know. She said, "What's that, Mommy?" She says, "It's a old man in a red suit begging for money. That's obvious." And there was a woman standing next to her that said, "Well, I've never heard anything like that," and so on. But this is what you do about Christmas. I mean, this is really a big issue. This is really a big issue. So I just simply say this to say that, you know, as soon as the Baha'i faith, I mean, you know equivalents of this here in Europe, okay? I remember, I was 6 years, I lived in Switzerland. I was even a member of the Swiss NSA in my previous incarnation. And and I lived here. I mean, so you Europeans know, I mean, one of the big things is wine, is alcohol, you know? I mean, how can, you know, you really do this without offending people, you know? And, you know, Baha'is expend immense amounts of time, you know, how can you get around this, you know, without shocking people and so on and so on? Well, I mean, you know, what people resent is self-righteousness. If you tell people anything with an air of presumed superiority, they're not going to like it. But if you tell them anything that's true in a spirit of true humility and love, they will respect you. They may not agree with you, but they'll respect you. So those are some thoughts. There are other thoughts. That's all right with that sort of upbeat at the end. He's my brother-in-law, okay?